So, the rank and file were violently torn between contraries. Then, out in front of them all, hundreds straggling behind him, in a great temper, Laocoon came tearing down from the citadel, crying from far, "Citizens, are you all stark mad? Do you really believe our foes are gone? Do you imagine any Greek gift is guileless? Is that your idea of Ulysses? This thing of wood conceals Greek soldiers, or else it is a mechanism designed against our walls, to pry into our homes and bear down on the city. Sure, some trick is there. No, you must never feel safe with the horse, Trojans. Whatever it is, I distrust the Greeks, even when they are generous." He spoke. He put forth his strength and spun his huge great spear at the flank of the monster, right into its belly's rounded frame. The spear stuck, quivering. The hollow womb of the creature grunted at the concussion and rumbled hollowly. If destiny, if our own will had not been so contrary, Laocoon would have made us rip open that cache of Greek troops. There'd still be a Troy. Oh, topless towers, you'd be standing now. But listen. Just at this moment, some Trojan shepherds were noisily dragging a young man, handcuffed, into our king's presence. The fellow had quite deliberately put himself in their path. He was assured in nerve, and prepared one way or the other, to bring off his underhand scheme, for they did not know him, or meet a certain death. His game was to prize open Troy for the Greeks. Eager to stare at him, the youth of Troy came mobbing all round the man, and vied in jeering at him for being captured. "Now hear how the Greeks tricked us. Learn from one case of their wickedness what every Greek is like." Well then, he came to a halt, stared at, worried, unarmed, stood there, and ran his eyes round the Trojan spectators, and spoke, "Oh God, is there now a single land or sea to accept me? What awaits me now at the latter end? Oh, it is hopeless. I have no foothold at all with the Greeks, and now the Trojans are my vindictive foes, and they will have my blood." His pitiable tones produced a revulsion of feeling. Our violence was checked. We encouraged him to tell us who he was, what he could say for himself, and what he relied on in letting himself be taken. Finally, he laid aside fear and spoke. "Sir, I will tell you all, of course, come what may, and tell you the whole truth. I will not deny that I am a Greek. This first, if fortune had cast Sinon for tragedy, she shall not wantonly shape me into a liar as well. Some talk has come to your ears, perhaps, about Palamedes of the family of Belus, and his bright reputation. Him the Greeks framed on a monstrous charge of being a traitor, and put him down to death, an innocent man, because he was against the war. Now they are sorry they killed him. Well, I was poor, so my father sent me to be his squire at an early age, since he was a relative of ours. While his authority was unshaken, his influence strong in our high command, I too enjoyed a certain distinction and honour. But when my kinsman, through the spiteful intrigues of Ulysses, I dare say you know the tale, was driven from the land of the living, I was ruined. I dragged out the days under a cloud, grieving, bitter about the downfall of my innocent friend. I had not the sense to keep quiet. I volunteered that if ever we won, and I got back to Greece, to my home, when a chance offered, I'd take revenge. Those words inspired a vicious hatred. From then, my fortune slipped. From then did Ulysses constantly persecute me with new slanders, dripping the subtle poison into the popular ear, and conspire to find allies against me. Nor did he rest until, with Calchas under his influence. But what's the point, I ask you, going on with the sorry tale and delaying you, if you think all Greeks are alike, and merely to be one condemns me? Take your long-due reprisal. Ulysses would love it. The sons of Atreus would pay you handsomely for it. Then, of course, we were all the more eager to find out the whole of his story. Greek cunning, evil on such a scale, being as yet beyond us. So he went on, trembling, and spoke with pretended emotion. Often, sick of the way the war dragged on, the Greeks longed to withdraw from Troy, to sail home and be shut of fighting, if only they'd done it. But always a stormy, vicious mood of the sea intervened, and the south wind frightened them off sailing. Especially when that horse, that fabric of maple, already was standing there, did the whole sky reverberate with storm clouds. In this quandary, we sent Eurypylus to inquire of Phoebus' oracle, who brought back this message of gloom from the shrine. With human sacrifice, O Greeks, with a young girl's blood did you appease the winds when first you sailed to Troy? With human blood, with a Greek life, you must make sacrifice if you're to get safe home. The words went round. Our people's spirits were paralyzed. An icy, shuddering coursed through their bones. Whom would fate fix on? Whom does Apollo require? At this stage, Ulysses made a great scene, pulling the seer Calchas into our midst, pestering him to tell us the gods' will. Yes, and already many surmised that I was that heartless schemer's victim, and silently saw what was coming. For 10 days Calchas was dumb, stayed in retreat, and would not name or commit to death anyone by his utterance. But at long last, as Ulysses got ever more importunate, according to plan he broke silence and smelt me out for the altar. They all approved. What each had feared for himself was easy to tolerate when it became the death of this one poor scapegoat. And now, the hideous day was here. The last rites made ready for me, the salted meal, the headband to go round my temples. I dodged away then from death, I confess it. I broke prison, and lay all night concealed in the mud of a lake, among reeds, giving them time to sail, on the chance that indeed they would sail. No more hope have I now of seeing the old country, seeing my little sons or the father I yearn for. On them, the Greeks, maybe, will exact reprisals because of my escape, and make them pay, poor things, with their life, for what I have done. Yet, by the gods, I beg you, by the high powers that are witness to truth, by fidelity, if anywhere upon earth she still can be found inviolate, I beg you to pity so dreadful an ordeal, pity one who has too much to bear. We gave him his life for those tears. They even aroused our compassion. Priam himself had once ordered the handcuffs, the cramping chains, to be struck off the fellow, and spoke him a friendly word. Whoever you are, from now on give up the Greeks, you are clear of them. Be one of us, and answer these questions of mine truthfully. Why did they build this huge monster of a horse? Who advised it? Is their object religious? Or was it to be some engine of war? So Priam spoke. Sinon, well up in the Greek art of trickery, raised to heaven his hands free of the fetters, crying, "You everlasting lights, and your inviolate deity, I call you to witness the altar too, and the damnable knife which I escaped, and the holy headband I wore to be sacrificed. No sin that I should relax the solemn code of the Greeks, no sin to loathe them, or to disclose their secrets, if any there are. I can have no guilt at law in my own land. Only abide by your promise, Trojans, and with your preserver keep faith, if my words prove true and give good value for sparing me. All the hope of the Greeks, their assurance in starting the war, was sustained by the backing of Pallas Athene. But when the godless Diomed and that master craftsman of crime, Ulysses, set out to steal Troy's luck, Athene's image, away from her holy place, massacred the sentries high on the citadel, snatched up the sacred image, and dared to lay their blood-stained hands on her virginal headband, from that day forth, the hopes of the Greeks were caught in an undertow and carried away. Their strength was shattered, for the goddess hardened her heart against them. Unmistakable were the signs of anger she gave us. The image was hardly set up in our camp when its eyes glared balefully, glittering fire. Salt sweat broke out all over it, and thrice, oh, supernatural, did the statue, untouched, dart forth from her base, the spear and shield she carried quivering. Straight away, Calchas pronounced we must dare the sea and be gone, for Troy would never now be destroyed by Greek weapons unless we sailed back home to fetch new luck and returned with the gods' blessing, as when we first sailed here in our fine ships. So at this moment they're running free towards Mycenae to get fresh force and the gods on their side again. They'll be back unexpectedly over the sea. So Calchas interprets the omens. Thus advised, they built this horse to dispel the curse of guilt for stealing Athene's image and wounding her godhead. But Calchas bade them build the horse of enormous size with strong oak planks, a real skyscraping monster, so that it could not get through your gates or be towed within the walls and thus become your guardian, serving the old cult. For if your hands had outraged this offering to Minerva, it would be quite disastrous. May the omen sooner recoil on its own profit, for Priam's rule and for the Trojans. But if your hands should have got the horse up into the city, then would you carry Asia in war right up to the Grecian strongholds. Such is the fate that is reserved for our children. Such was the artful, treacherous perjury Sinon used to impose on us. We were tricked by cunning and crocodile tears. We, whom neither Diomed nor Larissian Achilles could conquer, not in 10 years, not with 1,000 warships. Just then another event, the most alarming yet, befell us wretches, muddling still further our hooded minds. Laocoon, whom we'd elected by lot as Neptune's priest, was sacrificing a great bull at the official altar, when over the tranquil deep from Tenedos we saw, telling it makes me shudder, twin snakes with immense coils thrusting the sea and together streaking towards the shore. Rampant they were among the waves, their blood-red crests reared up over the water. The rest of them slithered along the surface, coil after coil sinuously trailing behind them. We heard a hiss of salt spray. Next, they were on dry land in the same field, a glare and blaze of bloodshot eyes, tongues flickering like flame from their mouths, and the mouths hissing. Our blood drained away at the sight. We broke and ran. The serpents went straight for Laocoon. First, each snake knotted itself round the body of one of Laocoon's small sons, hugging him tight in its coils, and cropped the piteous flesh with its fangs. Next thing, they fastened upon Laocoon as he hurried, weapon in hand, to help the boys, and lashed him up in their giant whirls. With a double grip round his waist and neck, the scaly creatures embrace him, their heads and throats powerfully poised above him. All the while, his hands are struggling to break their knots. His priestly headband is spattered with blood and pitchy venom. All the while, his appalling cries go up to heaven, a bellowing, such as you hear when a wounded bull escapes from the altar, after it shrugged off an ill-aimed blow at its neck. But now the twin monsters are gliding away and escaping towards the shrine of relentless Minerva, high up on our citadel, disappearing behind the round of the goddess' shield at her feet there. Then, my God, a strange panic crept into our people's fluttering hearts. They argued Laocoon had got what he deserved for the crime, the sacrilege of throwing his spear at the wooden horse, and so profaning its holiness with the stroke. "Bring the horse to Minerva's shrine. Pray for her goodwill," all of our people shouted. We cut into our walls, laid open the heart of the city. Everyone set about the task. We inserted rollers under its hooves, put hawsers of hemp around its neck, and strained. The disastrous engine was jockeyed over our walls, an army in its womb. Boys and unmarried maidens escorted it, singing psalms, joyfully gripping the traces. The menace mounts, comes trundling into the city centre. O my country, O Ilium, home of the gods, O Troy town, famous through war. 4 times the monster stopped at entrance, and every time it stopped, the accoutrements clanged in its belly. Yet we persevered, with never a thought. We were madly blind, until we had lodged the ominous thing in our holy place. Then, to cap it all, Cassandra opened her mouth for prophecy. She whom her god had doomed to be never believed by the Trojans. But we poor fools, whose very last day it was, festooned the shrines of the gods with holiday foliage all over the city. So now the sky rolled round, and night raced up from the ocean, voluminously shrouding the earth and heaven's vault and the villainous scheme of the Greeks. Not a sound from the Trojans, supine along the walls, tired out in the embrace of sleep. And now the main Greek army was moving from Tenedos in fleet formation, under the favouring silences of a quiet moon, towards the coast they knew so well. Their leading galley had signalled with flame. Sinon, protected by fate's injustice, stealthily unlocked the wooden horse and let the Greeks out from its belly. The horse disgorged the men, burst revelling forth from its hollow flank into the fresh air, the Sander and Thenelus in the lead, with Ulysses the Terrible sliding down a rope they had lowered, Acamas, Thoas, Neoptolemus son of Peleus, Machaon and Menelaus, and Epius, the man who had actually built the clever contraption. They broke out over a city drowned in drunken sleep. They killed the sentries, and then threw open the gates, admitting their main body, and joined in the prearranged plan of attack. It was the hour when worn-out men begin to get some rest, and by God's grace genial sleep steals over them. I dreamt, I seemed to behold our Hector standing before me, most woe-begone and shedding great tears, just as he'd looked once in death after being dragged by the chariot, black with the dirt and blood, his swollen feet pierced where the thongs had been threaded. Ah, God, what a sight he was! How terribly changed from the Hector who once came back arrayed in the armour of Achilles, who came back from bombarding the Greek navy with fire. Now his beard is matted, clotted with blood, his hair. He exhibits the many wounds received while defending his country in combat around the walls. I, too, am weeping. Unasked, I address him in my dream, force out these sorrowful words. O light of Troy, O surest hope of the Trojans, what has been keeping you so long? What shores do you come from, Hector? Long have we looked for you. How happily now we behold you, we whom the death of many friends, the manifold ordeal of city and folk have exhausted. But why is your face, serene once, so shamefully disfigured? Why do I see these wounds? He gave no heed to these futile questions of mine, but heaving a heavy sigh from the depth of his heart, spoke out, "Goddess-born, you must go. You must save yourself from these flames. The enemies within the gates. Troy's tower is falling, falling. You owe no more to your country or Priam. If strong right hands could save our town, this hand of mine would have saved it long ago. Her holy things, her home gods, Troy commends to your keeping. Take these as partners in your fate. For these search out the walls you are destined to build after long roaming the seaways." He spoke. He picked up the holy headbands, the puissant Vesta, and her undying fire from out the temple sanctuary. Meantime, Troy was shaken through and through by her last pangs. Yes, more and more. Although the house of my father, Anchises, lay far back from the street, detached and screened by trees, the sounds of death came clearly. The battle alarum swelled. I shook myself out of sleep, and clambering onto the ridge of the roof, I stood up there, straining my ears to listen. You know how it is when southerly gales are fanning a fire through a cornfield, or when a torrent, inspate with mountain water, smears flat the fields, flattens the crops which the oxen have worked for, drags forests down in its course. How then, a shepherd perched on a rock, hearing the noise, is bemused and quite at a loss. Now what I saw in my dream came true, and the Greek's treachery was plain to behold. Deiphobus' house flared up and hugely collapsed. The house of Eucalagon next door was blazing. You could see the flames reflected all over the Sigean straits. Everywhere rose the shouting of men, the braying of trumpets. Madly I snatch up my arms, beyond thinking how best to employ them. Only I'm wild to rally some fighters and counterattack to relieve the citadel. Blind rage and desperation drive me. One thought comes, that death in battle is a fine thing. But look, Panthus arrives, having got through the Greek barrage. Panthus, the son of Othrys, Apollo's priest of the citadel. Holding the hallows, his conquered divinities, and leading his little grandson, he frantically has made his way to my doorstep. Where is the core of the fighting? What is our rallying point? I had hardly spoken these words when he, with a sob, replied, "The very last day has come, the hour inevitable for Troy. We Trojans, with Ilium and all its Teucrian glory, are things of the past, for cruel Jove has quite gone over to the Greeks. The city's on fire. The Greeks are masters here." The towering horse which stands in the heart of the city spilt out armed men, and flushed with triumph, Sinon is stirring the blaze everywhere. There are Greeks packing the opened gates, all who ever came in their thousands from Mycenae. Wherever the roads are narrow, they're blocked by Greek detachments. A front of steel stands there. The sword points glitter. The swords are bared to kill. The sentries guarding our gates could hardly begin to resist or put up a fight in the blinding darkness. So Panthus spoke, revealing the will of heaven. His words drove me towards the burning, the fighting. I heard the call of war's somber fury, a dull roar, and shouts flung up to heaven. Now Ripius and champion Epitus, looming up in the moonlight, Hipponus and Dymas were there to reinforce me and fell in at my side, together with young Coroebus, son of Mygdon. Coroebus, it happened, had come to Troy but recently, impelled by a crazy love for Cassandra, bringing a son-in-law's aid to Priam and the Trojans. Hard luck that he did not listen to his prophetic Cassandra's warnings. Well, when I saw them in close formation and good shape for battle, I spoke to inspire them further. "Men, dear hearts, so vainly valiant, if you are set on following one who intends to see the business through to the end, this is the picture. The gods, by whose grace our kingdom once stood, have washed their hands of us, abandoning shrine and altar. The city you would relieve is ablaze. Let us die. Let us charge into the battle's heart. Losers have one salvation, to give up all hope of salvation." So I fired my men with the fury of desperation. Then, just like marauding wolves in a black fog, at a time when their rabid hunger has sent them blindly prowling, and the cubs they have left are waiting at home, their gullets parched, so through the enemy barrage we went as to certain death. We steadily made for the heart of the city, and were engulfed in the black night's ambient shade. That night! What words can render its deaths and its disaster? What tears can rise to the level of all that was suffered then? An ancient city is falling after long years of power. So many motionless bodies prostrated everywhere along the streets, in the houses, on the gods' holy thresholds. Not the Trojans alone paid their account in blood. There were times when courage returned even though we knew we were beaten, and then the conquering Greeks fell. All over the town you saw heart-rending agony, panic, and every shape of death. The first to cross our path was Androgeus, with a fair-sized body of Greeks around him. He thought, in his ignorance, we were friends, and went so far as to hail us with comradely words. "Get going, men! Whatever has kept you so long? What do you mean by this slackness? The rest of the Greeks have been burning and sacking Ilium, and here are you only just turned up from the ships." he spoke, and at once, for he got no satisfactory answer, it dawned on him that the men he'd fallen in with were hostile. Startled, he brought up sharp, checked speech, winced away. Like one who, forcing his way through sharp briars, accidentally has trod on a snake, and in sudden panic shudders away from its angrily rearing head, its gunmetal neck puffed out. Androgeus, unnerved at the sight of us, made to retreat. We went for him and his party, surrounded them, and since they had no local knowledge and were paralyzed with fear, picked them off one by one. So fortune favored our first move. Flown with success and in high spirits, Coroebus exclaimed, "Comrades, let's follow up where fortune has first shown us a way to survival and play our luck while it is good. Change shields with these dead Greeks, put on their badges and flashes. Craft or courage, who cares when an enemy has to be beaten? The Greeks themselves shall equip us." So saying, he put on Androgeus' plumed helmet, his shield with its fine heraldic device, and fitted onto his side the Argive sword. Ripius and Dymas, too, and all our warriors gleefully followed suit, each arming himself from the spoils just taken. Then we went on through the press of the Greeks, under false favours of alien gods. Many a sharp engagement we fought in the blindfold night, and many a Greek we dispatched to Hades. Some broke and ran for the ships, ran for the sure protection the beaches gave. One lot, driven by sheer cowardice, climbed the horse again and returned to the womb they had come from. Ah, well, there's no trusting the gods for anything once they're against you. Over there was Priam's daughter, Cassandra, her hair flying, being dragged away from Minerva's house, from its very sanctuary, her burning eyes uplifted to heaven, but in vain. Her eyes, for she could not lift her delicate palms, they were pinioned. Coroebus found this sight too much. In a passion of rage he bores right into the thick of the foe. He wants to be killed. We followed him, all of us, attacking in close order. Now we were first mown down by the fire of our own side, shooting from the high temple roof. A deplorable slaughter began through mistaken identity, our Greek equipment and crests. Next, the Greeks rallied, shouting with rage at the attempt to rescue Cassandra. They went for us, Ajax most vindictively, and the two sons of Atreus, with the whole battalion of Dolopes. So, when a hurricane breaks, you may get a clash and a tussle of winds, the west, the south, and the east wind rough-riding his orient steeds. Then forests whine, and Nereus in wild rage churns the sea with his trident and raises it mountains high. More Greeks appeared now, the ones whom in the confusing darkness of night our ruse had routed and stampeded over the town. These were the first to recognize our shields, our fraudulent weapons. They noticed, too, the foreign tongue which gave us away. Well, this was it. We were crushed by weight of numbers. Coroebus went down to Peneleus' sword at the altar of the war-puissant goddess. Then Ripius fell, he who of all the Trojans was most fair-minded, the one who was most regardful of justice. God's ways are inscrutable. Now Hipponus fell, and Dymas, shot by their own friends, and Panthus, not all his goodness nor the headband he wore as Apollo's priest, saved him from death. O ashes of Ilium, O flames that my world died in! I call you to witness that I, at your setting, was facing the Greeks' fire, evading no danger in combat. If fate had meant me to die then, I'd have earned that death by the way I fought. But soon, myself, Iphitus and Peleus were drawn away, Iphitus being old, and Peleus slowed down by a wound Ulysses had given him. Urgently summoned by war cries, we heard from the palace of Priam. Here we beheld so tremendous a struggle as made it seem that nowhere else in the city could men be fighting and dying. A bitter battle. The Greeks trying to scale the walls and ramming a compact wedge of shields at the door they assaulted. They advance ladders to the walls. Hard by the very doorposts they climb the rungs, with left hands holding their shields above them to ward off missiles and grasping the battlements with their right hands. The Trojans, for their part, are stripping the turrets and rooftops, ready, since now the end is in sight, to use the material for missiles, to put up a stern defense, though death is upon them. Yes, they throw down even the gilded beams, the pride of their ancestors, while others cluster to guard the doors below with a thick-set hedge of naked swords. Our courage rekindled now. We would seek to succor the king's palace, reinforce the defenders, and lend our strength to the conquered. There was a door, a secret entrance by which you went from one block to another, a postern out of the way behind the palace. By this, while our empire stood, Andromache, poor soul, would often come unattended to visit her husband's parents, bringing her child, Astyanax, to his grandsire. Using this door, I got out onto the rooftop, whence the luckless Trojans were raining missiles, all to no purpose. A tower stood over the sheer of the wall, its apex soaring skyward. This tower commanded a long familiar prospect across Troyland to the Greek ships and the Achaean lines. This we attacked with crowbars all round, where the weak joints of its flooring offered a purchase, prized it off from its deep bed, and pushed hard at it. The tower tottered and fell full length with a sudden crash, bursting all over the massed attackers. But still others came on. Still it rained spears and arrows and stones and every missile unceasingly. Right on the very threshold of the entrance hall was Pyrrhus in all his insolent glory, aglitter with bronze accoutrements. So a snake comes out, full fed on malignant herbs, a snake which winter has kept underground, sullenly brewing its poison. But now it has sloughed its old skin, is young again and glistening. It coils along on its slithering belly, and lifts to the sunlight its vertical throat, and flickers a tongue like forked lightning. With Pyrrhus were giant Periphas, and Achilles' old charioteer Automedon, now a squire, and all the Scyrian brigade, assaulting the palace and tossing firebrands up at its roof. Pyrrhus himself, in the lead, seized an axe, and battering the stout door, smashed through it, and wrenched it away from its hinges, though it was strengthened with bronze. Now he had hewed out a panel, and made a hole in the tough wood, opening up a gap the size of a window. Through this they are able to see the interior, the long gallery, the private rooms of Priam and Troy's old kings are exposed, and they see the armed defenders packing the doorway within. Inside the palace all was confusion, groans, agony. The echoing halls resounded through and through with the keening of women, whose wails and shrieks beat at the golden stars. Mothers, distracted with fear, were wandering about the palace, clinging tight to its doorposts and kissing them goodbye. Pyrrhus attacks with his father's dash. Neither the bolts nor the guards have the strength to withstand it. Stroke upon stroke, a ram weakens the door, till it's torn away from its hinges and falls in. Brute force has made a breach. The Greeks go storming through, massacre those in their way, and the place overflows with soldiery. More violent it was than when, banks broken, a foaming river pours through. The dikes have gone down to the thrust of the water, and now in a mass it raves forth over the fields, swirling the herds and their shippons across the plain. I had to watch Pyrrhus, crazed with bloodlust, and the brothers Atrides, there on the threshold, Hecuba with her 100 princesses, and Priam sullying all over with blood the altar whose fire he had consecrated. Those 50 bridal rooms that promised a rich posterity, fallen flat were their doors, proudly adorned with eastern gold and with spoils. Wherever there was no fire, the Greeks were. I dare say you are wondering what happened to Priam then. Once he had seen how the captured city was faring, seen his doors were hacked away and the enemy deep in the palace, Priam, though tremulous with old age, donned the armour he had not worn for years, a pathetic gesture, strapped on his useless sword, and was moving deathwards against the foe. In the central court, Beneath the uncovered sweep of the sky stood a massive altar, and near it a very old laurel tree leaned over the altar, enfolding the home gods with its shade. Here Hecuba and her daughters, like a flock of doves dashed down by a black storm, were sitting huddled about the altars that would not protect them, and clasping the images of the gods. Now, when she saw Priam dressed up in his youthful armor, she cried, "Oh, my poor husband! What fatal intention has made you take up arms like this? Where are you running? Our present predicament is beyond such aid. Weapons won't save us, nor would they save us even if my own Hector was here now. Please, come back over here. This altar shall guard us all, or else we will die together." This did she say, and taking the old king to her, made him sit down in sanctuary. But picture it. Priam's son, Polites, had just avoided a death blow from Pyrrhus, and wounded was running the enemy gauntlet, running away down the long colonnades and across the great hall alone. Pyrrhus hotly pursued him, always about to strike, each moment seeming to have him, so close did the spear point come. Just when Polites emerged before his parents' eyes, he fell, and his life ebbed out in a deep river of blood. Priam, though death now ringed him round, could not be passive, could not refrain from uttering his indignation. He cried, "Hear me, you criminal! If there is any justice in heaven, any eye for such things, may the gods pay you the due reward and unstintingly show their gratitude for this most monstrous crime you have committed, making me witness my son's death, fouling a father's eyes like this with the sight of murder. You are poles apart from Achilles, your father, you lyingly claim. He treated me differently, far, though I was his foe. He respected a suppliant's rights, gave up the bloodless remains of Hector for burial, and gave me safe conduct back to my city." So saying, the old man flung his weapon, but harmlessly, no strength behind it. A clang when the shield of Pyrrhus parried it, and then the spear was dangling impotently from its center. Pyrrhus replied, "All right. You shall go and carry a message to my father Achilles. Remember to tell him what a milksop his son has become, and what shocking deeds he has committed. Now, die!" Even as he spoke, he dragged the old man, trembling and sliding in the pool of his son's blood, right to the altar, twined Priam's hair in his left hand, raised with his right the flashing sword, and sank it up to the hilt between his ribs. Such was Priam's end, the close decreed by destiny, that in his dying hour he should see Troy blazing, falling. His Troy, which boasted once such a wealth of lands and subjects, the mistress of Asia once. A great trunk lies on the shore, a head torn from the shoulders, a body without a name. Then, first, the full horror of it all was borne in upon me. I stood in a daze. The picture of my dear father came to mind, as I watched King Priam, a man of the same age, cruelly wounded, gasping his life away. I pictured my Creusa deserted, my home pillaged, and the fate of my little Ascanius. I glanced round, wishing to see what force of men was left me. All were gone. Utter exhaustion and sickness of heart had made them drop from the roof to the ground or into the flames. Yes, I was now the one man left of my party. But just then, hugging close to the threshold of Vesta, speechlessly hiding there, I noticed the daughter of Tyndareus, Helen. The blaze lit up the whole scene as I wandered, peering this way and that. Helen, the scourge of Troy and her own land alike, in dread anticipation of Trojan wrath at Troy's downfall, of Greek revenge, of her cuckolded husband's anger. Helen, that hateful creature, was crouched by the altar in hiding. A fire broke out in my heart, a passion of rage to avenge my country's fall and punish her crime by a crime upon her. Was she going to get away with it? See Sparta again and her homeland? Return as a queen in triumph? Be once more reunited with husband, home, parents and children? Use our Trojan ladies for her attendants and Trojan men for slaves? All this, with Priam put to the sword and Troy in ashes, and Troy's shore time and again bathed in a sweat of blood? Not so, I said. For although to kill a woman earns one no fame, and victory over a female wins no decorations, I shall be praised for stamping out an iniquity, punishing one who so richly deserves it, and I shall enjoy fulfilling my soul with a flame of vengeance, appeasing my people's ashes. Such were my thoughts, the insensate fury that drove me onward, when to my view, and never before had I seen her so clear, my gentle mother appeared. All glowing with light she came through the gloom, a goddess manifest, oh, high and handsome as the heaven-dwellers know her. She laid a hand on mine, restraining me, then shaped these words with her rosy lips. My son, what anguish spurs you to this ungoverned rage? What madness has driven all thought for love out of your heart? Will you not first find out if your aged father Anchises is where you left him, and whether your wife Creusa be still alive and little Ascanius? A whole Greek army is surging round them on every side, and but for my guardian care, the flames would have got them by now. The fell sword drained their blood. It is not the beauty of hated Helen. It is not Paris, though you hold him to blame. The gods, I tell you, are hostile. It's they who have undermined Troy's power and sent it tumbling. Look, I shall wipe away the cloud which now occludes and dulls your mortal vision, even as you gaze, the dank mist befogging you. Fear not to do whatever your mother tells you, and willingly be guided by me. Now, look at that litter of masonry there, huge blocks, stone torn from stone, and the dust-laden smoke billowing up from the debris. It's Neptune's work. He gores and tosses with his great trident the walls, the foundations, until the whole city is disemboweled. Look over there, at the Scaean gate. Panoplied Juno heads the shock troops, and in a vindictive fury calls up her allies from the ships. Look round! See, Pallas Athene, planted upon the citadel. The storm cloud is lurid about her, the Gorgon glares from her shield. Jove supplies fresh courage and a victorious strength to the Greeks, inciting the gods against the Trojan cause. Escape then while you may, my son, and end this ordeal. I shall be with you, seeing you safe to your father's house. She had spoken, and now she was vanished into the night's thick darkness. Terrible shapes loom up, set against Troy, the shapes of heaven's transcendent will. Then indeed I saw that all Ilium was subsiding into the flames, and Neptune's Troy quite overthrown. Imagine a veteran ash tree upon some mountain top, when woodsmen are working to fell it, with blow upon blow of their axes vigorously hacking. The tree seems always about to fall. It nods, and the topmost leaves are shivered by each concussion. Little by little their blows master it, till at last, with a great groan, it snaps off and falls full length on the hillside. Well, I went down from the roof, and divinely guided pressed on through flame and foe. The weapons gave way, the flames drew back for me. But when I reached the door of my father's house, the ancestral home, my father Anchises, whom first I looked for, wishing to get him away first to the safety of the hills, Anchises flatly refused to prolong his life, now Troy was finished, or to endure exile. He said, O you, whose blood is in the prime, who are strong enough to stand on your own feet, do you try for escape? But as for me, if the gods had meant me to go on living, they'd have preserved this place. Enough, more than enough, to have seen Troy ruined once, and once to have survived her capture. Bid me farewell, and leave. Oh, leave this body of mine where it is. I shall find death in action. The foe will slay me for pity, or spoils. And to bury me, that will not cost them much. For years now I have been lingering, obnoxious to heaven and useless to mankind, ever since the ruler of gods and men blasted me with the searing breath of his levin flash. So he went on saying, We could not shift him. Although we implored him with floods of tears, I and my wife Creusa, Ascanius, and the whole household, not to ruin everything, not to add his weight to the doom which was heavy upon us. He refused. Obstinately he clung to his house and his purpose. Once again I am moved to fight, yearning for death in my misery, since neither luck nor forethought offered a way out now. Father, I said, did you really think I could run away and leave you? Did so shameful a notion escape your lips? If it's the will of heaven that nothing be left of our city, and if your mind's made up that you and your family shall perish as well as Troy, a door to that death is wide open. Pyrrhus is coming, all bathed in Priam's blood. He loves butchering sons in front of their fathers, fathers at the altar. Was it for this, dear mother, you fetched me through fire and steel, that I should witness the enemy right in our house, witness Ascanius and my father and my Creusa beside them lying slaughtered here in one another's blood? To arms, my men, to arms! Their last hour calls the conquered. Send me back to the Greeks. Let me go back and renew the fight. It must never be said we died unavenged this day. My sword was at my side again. I was fitting my left arm through the strap of my shield, and on my way out of the house when Creusa clung to me at the door, gripping my ankles, holding little Ascanius up to his father, and crying, If it's deathwards you go, take us with you. Oh, take us and come what may. But if your experience tells you that something is to be gained by fighting, protect this house first. Think what you're leaving us to. Ascanius, your father, and me who loved to be called your wife once. Loudly she cried these words, and filled the house with her crying. Just then, a miracle happened. A wonderful miracle. Imagine it. Our hands and our sad eyes were upon Ascanius, when we beheld a feathery tongue of flame, luminously alight on his head, licking the soft curls with fire that harmed them not, and playing about his temples. Anxious, in great alarm, his mother and I hurried to put out with water that holy blaze on his hair. But Father Anchises, greatly heartened, lifted his eyes up, stretched up his hands to heaven with words of prayer, saying, O God omnipotent, if any prayers can sway you, give ear to mine. One thing I ask, if by our goodness we have deserved it, grant your aid, confirm this omen. The old man had hardly spoken, when from our left hand came a sudden crash of thunder, and a shooting star slid down the sky's dark face, drawing a trail of light behind it. We watched that star as it glided high over the palace roof, and blazing a path, buried its brightness deep in the woods of Ida. When it was gone, it left in its wake a long furrow of light, and a sulphurous smoke spread widely over the terrain. That did convince my father. He drew himself upright, addressed the gods above, and worshipped the heaven-sent star. No more! No more lingering! I follow! I'm there where you guide me! Gods of our fathers, guard this family, guard my grandson. This sign is yours, and Troy is still in your heavenly keeping. Yea, I consent. I refuse no longer, my son, to go with you. He had spoken, and now more clearly over the town the fire's roar was heard, and nearer rolled the tide of its conflagration. "Quick, then, dear father," I said. "Climb onto my back, and I will carry you on my shoulders. That's a burden will not be burdensome. However things turn out, at least we shall share one danger, one way of safety, both of us. Let little Ascanius walk beside me, and Creusa follow my steps at a distance. And you, servants, pay careful attention to what I shall tell you. As you go out of the city, you come to a mound with an ancient temple of Ceres upon it, secluded. Nearby, an old cypress stands, which for many years our fathers preserved in reverence. Let this be our rendezvous. We'll get there by different routes. Do you, my father, carry the sacred relics and home gods? Sinful for me to touch them, when I have just withdrawn from battle with blood on my hands, until in running water I am purified. With these words, I laid the pelt of a tawny lion for covering over my broad shoulders and bowed neck, then stooped to lift my burden. Ascanius twined his fingers in mine, hurrying to keep up with his father's longer stride. My wife came on behind. We fared on, hugging the shadows. I, who just now had faced the enemy volleys, the Greeks' concentrated attack, without turning a hair, I was scared by every breeze, alarmed by every sound, so strung up was I with anxiety for my burden and my companion. And now I was nearing the gates and thinking that we had made it, when on a sudden there came to my ears the sound of many footsteps, or so it seemed. Then, peering into the gloom, my father exclaimed, "Run! They're upon us! Run, Aeneas! I can see the shine of their shields and the bronze accoutrements winking!" Well, I panicked. My wits were fuddled, were snatched away by some malignant prompting, for even as I darted off into byways, off my course among streets I knew not, oh God, the anguish of it! My wife, Creusa, fate took her. Did she stop there, or lose her way? Did she sink down in exhaustion? We never knew. We never set eyes on her again. I did not look back for the lost one. I did not give her a thought until we had reached the mound, the ancient hallowed place of Ceres. Here, at last, when all were assembled, one was missing. One had denied husband and son her company. I was out of my mind. What mortal, what god did I not curse? In all the city's ruin, what bitterer thing did I see? Commending Ascanius, Anchises, and the Teucrian home gods to my friend's care, and hiding them deep in the hollow vale, I put on my shining armour. I made for the city once more. To reconstruct those events, to retrace our path through Troy and expose my life to its perils again, that was my purpose. For a start, I returned to the shadowed gate in the city wall by which I had sallied forth, noting my tracks and following them back through the night, straining my eyes to scan them. Everywhere, dread and the sheer silence reduced my courage to nothing. Next, I went home, in case, just on the chance that she might have gone there. The Greeks had broken in. The whole house was occupied. That instant gluttonous fire was fanned by the draught right up to the rooftop. Flames burst out there. The blast of the heat roared skywards. I went on to revisit Priam's house and the citadel. Here, in the empty colonnades of Juno's sanctuary, Phoenix and fell Ulysses were engaged on the duty allotted them, guarding the loot. To this point from all over Troy had plunder salvaged from burning shrines been brought. Tables of gods, solid gold bowls and looted vestments were being piled up here in heaps. Children and frightened mothers were standing about in a long queue. I dared, you will hardly believe it, to call out loud through the gloom and fill the streets with shouting. Sadly I cried, "Creusa!" called to her over and over again, but it was no good. As I roamed on that endless, frenzied search through the city buildings, there appeared before my eyes a piteous phantom. Yes, the very ghost of Creusa, a figure larger than life. I was appalled. My hair stood on end, and my voice stuck in my throat. It was she who spoke then, and thus relieved my pain. "Darling husband, it's madness for you to indulge your grief like this. These happenings are part of the divine purpose. It was not written that you should bring Creusa away with you. The great ruler of heaven does not allow it. For you, long exile is destined, broad tracts of sea to be furrowed. Then you will reach Hesperia, where Lydian Tiber flows gently through a land in good heart, and good men live. There your affairs will prosper. A kingdom, a royal bride, await you. No more tears now for your heart's love, Creusa. I shall not see the proud halls of the Myrmidons or the Dolopes, nor work as a slave for Greek women, I, who am Dardan and daughter-in-law to the goddess Venus. No, the great mother of the gods is going to keep me here. Goodbye, Aeneas. Cherish our love in the sun it gave us." With these words, though I wept and had so much to say to her, she left me, fading out into thin air. 3 times I tried to put my arms round her neck, and 3 times the phantom slipped my hands, my vain embrace. It was like grasping a wisp of wind or the wings of a fleeting dream. So in the end I went back to my friends, the night being over. I was astonished to find, when I got there, a great number of new arrivals come in, both women and men, a sorry concourse of refugees, assembled for exile. From all sides they'd come together, their minds made up, their belongings ready, for me to lead them wherever I wished across the sea. And now was the dawn star rising over the ridges of Ida, bringing another day. The Greeks were holding the gates of the city in force. Troy was beyond all hope of aid. I accepted defeat, picked up my father, and made for the mountains. Book 3. After the gods had seen fit to destroy our Asian empire and Priam's innocent people, after proud Ilium's fall, when Neptune's Troy was an area of flattened, fuming rubble, we were impelled by signs from heaven to go into exile in some far-off and virgin land. Hard by Antandros, at the foot of Phrygian Ida, we labored to build a fleet, not knowing where destiny would lead us or let us settle, and mustered our company. In the first days of summer, Father Anchises bade us hoist our sails to fate. I was in tears as I left my country's coast, the harbor, the plain where Troy had stood. Homeless, I took to the deep sea. I, with my friends, my son, my home gods, and the great gods. Yonder there lay a land of broad plains tilled by the Thracians, a land protected by Mars, ruled once by hot-tempered Lycurgus, allied with Troy from of old through friendly relations and marriage, while fortune smiled on us. Thither I went, and began to build a town by its shore, an enterprise which fate was biased against, and made up its name for my own, Aeneas. I was sacrificing to Venus my mother, and to the rest of the gods, that they should bless our project, was sacrificing a sleek bull on the shore to the king of the heaven-dwellers. There was a dune nearby, as it chanced, topped by brushwood of cornel and of myrtle sprouted with thick-set shafts. I approached it, wanting some foliage to festoon over the altar, and tried to root up its dense greenery. As I did so, I saw an uncanny thing, which horrifies me to speak of. From the first sapling that I tore up, its roots dissevered, there oozed out, drop by drop, a flow of black blood, fouling the earth with its stains. My whole frame shook in a palsy of chilly fear, and my veins were ice-bound. Well, I proceeded to pluck out the whippy shaft of another sapling. I wanted to investigate the mystery and get at the reason for it. From the bark of this one, too, there issued the black blood. Pondering much, I prayed to the deities of the woodland and Gradivus, who looks after the Thracian fields, that they should take the sting out of the omen and turn it to our advantage. But when, with my knees deep in the